Chapter 64. That God governs things by His providence. From what has been laid down in the preceding chapters, it has been sufficiently proved that God is the end of all, whence we may further conclude that by His providence He governs or rules all. For whenever certain things are ordered to a certain end, they are all subject to the disposal of the one to whom chiefly that end belongs. This may be seen in an army, since all the parts of the army, and their actions, are directed to the good of the general, victory to wit, as their ultimate end, for which reason the government of the whole army belongs to the general. In the same way, that art which is concerned with the end dictates and gives laws to the art which is concerned with things directed to the end, as civics controls the military art, and this directs the art of horsemanship, and the art of sailing, the art of shipbuilding. Since then all things are directed to the divine goodness as their last end, as we have shown above, it follows that God, to whom that goodness belongs chiefly as essentially possessed, understood and loved, must be the governor of all. Again, whoever makes a thing for the sake of an end makes use of it for that end. Now it has been shown above that whatsoever has being in any way is an effect of God, and that God makes all things for an end which is Himself. Therefore He uses everything by directing it to its end. But this is to govern. Therefore God, by His providence, is the governor of all. Besides, it has been shown that God is the first unmoved mover. Now the first mover moves no less than second movers, more so indeed, because without Him they do not move other things. But all things that are moved for an end, as was shown above. Therefore God moves each thing to its end. Moreover He moves them by His intellect, for it has been proved above, that He moves not by natural necessity, but by intellect and will. Now to rule and govern by providence is nothing else but to move certain things to their end by one's intellect. Therefore God by His providence governs and rules all things that are moved to their end, whether they be moved corporally or spiritually, as the seeker is set to be moved by the object desired. Moreover, it was proved that natural bodies are moved and work towards an end, although they have no knowledge of an end, from the fact that always or nearly always that which is best happens to them, nor would they be made otherwise if they were made by art. Now it is impossible that things without knowledge of an end should act for an end, and attain to that end in an orderly manner, unless they be moved to that end by one who has knowledge of the end, as the arrow is directed to the mark by the archer. Therefore the whole operation of nature must be directed by some knowledge. This must be traced back to God mediately or immediately, because every subordinate art and knowledge must take its principles from a higher one, as may be seen in speculative and practical sciences. Therefore God governs the world by His providence. Further, things in nature distinct do not converge into one order, unless they be brought together by one controller. Now the universe is composed of things distinct from one another and of contrary natures, and yet they all converge into one order, some things acting on others, some helping or directing others. Therefore there must be one ordainer and governor of the universe. Moreover, natural necessity cannot be alleged as the reason for the various phenomena to be observed in the movements of the heavenly bodies, since the movements of some are more numerous than, and wholly different from, the movements of others. Therefore the ordering of their movements must come from some providence, and consequently so must the ordering of all those movements and operations here below, that are controlled by the former movements. Besides, the nearer a thing is to its cause, the greater share it has in the effect. Wherefore if we observe that a thing is the more perfectly shared by certain individuals, according as these are nearer to a certain thing, this is a sign that this thing is the cause of that which is shared in various degrees. Thus, if certain things are hotter according as they are nearer fire, this shows that fire is the cause of their heat. Now we see that things are all the more perfectly ordered according as they are nearer to God, for in the lower bodies, which are farthest removed from God by unlikeness of nature, we sometimes find defects from the ordinary course of nature, as in monstrosities and other casual happenings, whereas this never happens in the heavenly bodies, although they are changeable in a certain degree, nor in the separate intellectual substances. Therefore, God is the cause of the entire order of things, and consequently He is the governor of the whole universe by His providence. Further, as we proved above, God brought all things into being, not by natural necessity but by His intellect and will. Now His intellect and will can have no other ultimate end but His goodness, namely the bestowal of His goodness on things, as was shown above. Things partake of the divine goodness by way of likeness, in being good themselves. And the greatest good in things made by Him, is the good consisting in the order of the universe, which is most perfect, as the philosopher says in divine scripture: "In like manner God saw all the things He had made, and they were very good," whereas of each single work it was said simply that they were good. Consequently, that which is chiefly willed and caused by God is the good consisting in the order of things of which He is the cause. But to govern things is nothing else but to impose order on them. Therefore God by His intellect and will governs all things. Moreover, whoever has an end in view, cares more for what is nearest to the last end, because the other ends are directed to this. Now the last end of God's will is His goodness, the nearest thing to which among created things is the good consisting in the order of the universe, because every particular good of this or that thing is ordained thereto as its end, just as the less perfect is ordained to that which is more perfect, even as each part is for the sake of its whole. Consequently, that which God cares for most in created things is the order of the universe, and therefore He governs it. Again, every created thing attains its ultimate perfection by its proper operation, because a thing's ultimate end and perfection must be either an operation or the term or effect of an operation, and the form whereby a thing is its first perfection, as stated in Tu De Anima I. Now the order among effects in respect of different natures and the degrees thereof issues from divine wisdom, as we showed in the second book. Therefore the order also among the operations, whereby things approach nearer to their ultimate end, does so in like manner. But to direct the actions of things to their end is to govern them. Therefore God by the providence of His wisdom governs and rules things. Hence Holy Writ acclaims God as Lord and King, according to Psalm 6. To the Lord, He is God, and Psalm 46, 8. God is the King of all the earth, because the King and Lord is He whose office it is to rule and govern subjects. Wherefore Holy Writ ascribes the course of events to the divine control, who commandeth the sun, and it riseth not, and shutteth up the stars, as it were under a seal, and He hath made a decree, and it shall not pass away. Hereby is refuted the error of some physicists of old, who held that everything happens from natural necessity, whence it followed that all things happen by chance, and not by the ordinance of providence. Chapter 65. That God preserves things in existence. From the fact that God governs things by His providence, it follows that He preserves them in existence. For everything whereby certain things obtain their end comes under the government of those things, because things are said to be governed or ruled according as they are directed to their end. Now things are directed to the ultimate end intended by God, the divine goodness, to wit, not only in that they operate, but also in the very fact that they exist, because inasmuch as they exist they bear a likeness to the divine goodness, which is the end of all things, as we have proved. Therefore it belongs to divine providence that things be preserved in existence. Again, the cause of a thing must needs be the same as the cause of its preservation, because preservation is nothing else than continued existence. Now we have shown above that God is the cause of everything's existence by His intellect and will. Therefore by His intellect and will He preserves things in existence. Besides, no particular univocal agent can be the cause of its species. Simply thus an individual man cannot be the cause of the human species, for then he would be the cause of every man, and consequently of himself, which is impossible. But properly speaking, the individual is the cause of the individual. Now the individual man exists for as much as the human nature is in this particular matter, which is the principle of his individuality. Therefore the human individual is not the cause of a man except in the point of his being the cause of the human form being in this particular matter, and this is to be the principle of the generation of this particular man. It is consequently evident that neither the individual man, nor any other natural univocal agent, is a cause except of the generation of an individual. Now there must needs be some per se active cause of the human species, as is evidenced by his composite nature, and the order of his parts, which is always the same, unless it be hindered accidentally, and the same applies to all other species of natural things. This cause is God either mediately or immediately, for it has been shown that he is the first cause of all. Consequently he stands in relation to the species of things as in nature the individual generator to the generation of which he is the cause per se. But generation ceases when the generator's action ceases. Therefore all the species of things would cease, were the divine operation to cease. Therefore by his operation he preserves things in existence. Moreover, although movement may accidentally belong to an existing thing, it is something additional to the thing's being. Now nothing corporeal is the cause of anything except in so far as it is moved, because no body acts except through movement, as Aristotle proves. No body is the cause of a thing's existence, as such, but it is the cause of a thing's being moved towards existence, that is, of its becoming. Now the existence of a thing is participated existence, since no thing is its own existence, save God, as we proved above. God, who is his own being, must be first and per se the cause of all being. Accordingly the divine operation stands in the same relation to the existence of things, as the movement of a corporeal mover to the being made and the being moved of things made or moved. Now it is impossible that a thing continue to be made or to be moved if the movement of the mover cease. Therefore a thing cannot possibly continue to exist except through the divine operation. Further, as the operation of art presupposes the operation of nature, so the operation of nature presupposes the creative operation of God, because art takes its matter from nature, and nature receives its matter from God through creation. Now the products of art are preserved in being by virtue of the products of nature, a house, for instance, by the solidity of the stones. Therefore all natural things would not continue to exist except by the power of God. Again, the impression of the agent does not remain in the effect, after the action of the agent has ceased, unless it merge into the nature of the effect, because the forms of things generated, and their properties, remain in them to the end after generation, because they become natural to them. In like manner the reason why habits are hard to remove is that they merge into the nature, whereas dispositions and passions, whether in the body or in the soul, remain for a time after the action of the agent, but not for always, because they are in their subject as preparing a way to nature. On the other hand, that which belongs to the nature of a higher genus nowise remains after the action of the agent. Thus light does not remain in the diaphanous body after the illuminant has been removed. Now existence is not the nature or essence of any created thing, but of God alone, as was proved in the first book. Therefore nothing could continue to exist if the divine operation were to cease. Further, there are two explanations of the origin of things. One is that proposed by faith, that things were first brought into being by God. The other is that of certain philosophers holding that things emanated from God from eternity. According to either explanation, it is necessary to say that things are preserved in existence by God. For if things were brought into being by God after not being, their existence as well as their non-existence must result from the divine will, because he permitted things not to be when he so willed, and caused them to be when he so willed. Therefore they exist so long as he wills them to exist. Therefore his will is the preserver of things. If on the other hand things emanated from God from eternity, we cannot assign a time or an instant when they first emanated from God either. Therefore, they were never produced by God, or their existence is always emanating from God, as long as they exist. Therefore he preserves things in existence by his operation. Hence it is said, upholding all things by the word of his power. Augustine too says, the potency of the Creator, and the power of the Almighty and All-Upholder, is the cause of every creature's subsistence. If this ruling power were withdrawn from his creatures, their form would cease at once, and all nature would collapse. When a man is building a house, and goes away, The building remains after he has ceased to work and has gone, whereas the world would not stand for a single instant if God withdrew his support. Hereby is refuted the statement of certain authorities quoted in the Law of the Moors, who, in order to be able to maintain that the world needs to be preserved by God, held that all forms are accidents, and that no accident lasts for 2 instants, so that things would always be in the process of formation, as though a thing needed not an active cause except while being made. Wherefore some of them are stated to have maintained that the indivisible bodies of which, they say, all substances are composed, and which alone, according to them, have any permanency, would be able for a time to remain in existence, if God were to withdraw his government from things. Some of these say indeed that things would not cease to exist unless God caused in them the accident of ceasing to be. All of which is plainly absurd. Chapter 66. That nothing gives existence except in so far as it acts by God's power. It is evident from what has gone before that all inferior agents do not give existence except in so far as they act by God's power. Nothing gives existence except in so far as it is a being in act. Now God preserves things in existence by his providence, as we have proved. Therefore it is by God's power that a thing causes existence. Again, when several different agents are subordinate to one agent, the effect that proceeds from them in common must needs be ascribed to them in so far as they are united together in partaking of the movement and power of that agent, for many things do not make one, except in so far as they are one. Thus it is clear that all the men in an army work in order to effect a victory, and this effect they bring about forasmuch as they are subordinate to the general, whose proper effect is the victory. Now it was shown in the first book that the first agent is God. Since then existence is the effect common to all agents, for every agent makes a thing to be actually, it follows that they produce this effect in so far as they are subordinate to the first agent, and act by its power. Besides, in all ordered active causes, the last thing in the order of generation and the first in the intention is the proper effect of the first cause. Thus the form of a house, which is the proper effect of the builder, comes into being after the cement, stones and timber have prepared the way, which is the work of the inferior workmen who are subject to the builder. Now in every action, actual being is the chief thing intended, and is the last thing in the order of generation, because, when it is obtained, the active principle ceases to act, and the passive principle ceases to be acted upon. Therefore existence is the proper effect of the first agent, namely God, and whatever gives being does so in so far as it acts by the power of God. Moreover, among the things that can be reached by the power of a secondary agent, the limit in goodness and perfection is that which comes within its range through the power of the first agent, because the secondary agent's power receives its complement from the first agent. Now the most perfect of all effects is being, since every nature and form is perfected through being actually, and is compared to actual being as a potentiality to act. Therefore existence is what secondary agents produce by the power of the first agent. Besides, the order of effects is according to the order of causes. Now the first of all effects is being, for all others are determinations of being. Therefore being is the proper effect of the first agent, and all other agents produce it by the power of the first agent. And secondary agents, which, as it were, particularize and determine the action of the first agent, produce the other perfections as their proper effects, which are particular kinds of being. Furthermore, that which is such by its essence is the proper cause of that which is such by participation. Thus fire is the cause of all things that are afire. Now God alone is being by his essence, while all others are beings by participation, for in God alone existence is his essence. Therefore the existence of every existing thing is his proper effect, so that whatever brings a thing into existence does so in so far as it acts by God's power. Wherefore it is said God created that all things might be, and in several passages of Holy Writ it is stated that God makes all things. Again in De Causis it is said that not even does an intelligence give being except in so far as it is something divine, i.e., in so far as it acts by God's power. Chapter 67. That in all things that operate, God is the cause of their operating. Hence it is clear that in all things that operate, God is the cause of their operating. For everyone that operates is in some way a cause of being, either of essential or of accidental being. But nothing is a cause of being except in so far as it acts by God's power. Therefore everyone that operates acts by God's power. Again, every operation consequent to a certain power is ascribed to the giver of that power as effect to cause. Thus the natural movement of heavy and light bodies is consequent to their form, whereby they are heavy or light. Wherefore the cause of their movement is said to be that which produced them and gave them their form. Now all power of any agent whatsoever is from God, as from the first principle of all perfection. Therefore since all operation is consequent to some power, it follows that God is the cause of every operation. Moreover, it is clear that every action that cannot continue after the influence of a certain agent has ceased, is from that agent. Thus the visibility of colors cannot continue after the action of the sun has ceased to enlighten the air. Wherefore without doubt it is the cause of the visibility of colors. The same applies to violent motion, which ceases when the violence of the impelling force has ceased. Now, since God not only gave existence to things when they first began to exist, but also causes existence in them as long as they exist, by preserving them in existence, as we have proved, so not only did he give them active forces when he first made them, but is always causing those forces in them. Consequently, if the divine influence were to cease, all operation would come to an end. Therefore every operation of a thing is reducible to him as its cause. Besides, whatever applies an active power to action is said to be the cause of that action. For the craftsman, when he applies the forces of nature to an action, is said to be the cause of that action, as the cook is the cause of cooking which is done by fire. Now every application of power to action is chiefly and primarily from God. For active forces are applied to their proper operations by some movement of the body or of the soul. Now the first principle of either movement is God, for he is the first mover, wholly immovable, as we have proved above. Likewise every movement of the will whereby certain powers are applied to action is reducible to God as the first object of appetite, and the first willer. Therefore every operation should be ascribed to God as its first and principal agent. Further, in all ordered active causes, the causes that follow must always act by the power of the first. Thus in natural things the lower bodies act by the power of the heavenly bodies, and in voluntary things all the inferior craftsmen act in accordance with the direction of the master craftsman. Now, in the order of active causes, God is the first cause, as we proved in the first book. Consequently all the lower active causes act by his power. Now the cause of an action is the thing by whose power it is done, more even than that which does it, even as the principal agent in comparison with the instrument. Therefore God is more the cause of every action than even secondary active causes. Further, every operator is directed through its operation to its ultimate end, since either the operation itself is its last end, or the thing operated, namely the effect of the operation. Now it belongs to God himself to direct things to their end, as we have proved. We must conclude that every agent acts by the power of God, and consequently it is he who causes the actions of all things. Hence it is said, Lord, thou hast wrought all our works in us, and without me you can do nothing. And it is God who worketh in us, both to will and to accomplish, according to his good will. For this reason Holy Writ often ascribes natural effects to the divine operation, because he it is who works in every agent, natural or voluntary. As it is written in Job 10:11, hast thou not milked me as milk, and curdled me like cheese? Thou hast clothed me with skin, thou hast put me together with bones and sinews. And again in Psalm 17:14, the Lord thundered from heaven, and the highest gave his voice, hail and coals of fire. Chapter 68. That God is everywhere. From this it is evident that God must be everywhere and in all things. For the mover and the thing moved must be simultaneous, as the philosopher proves. Now God moves all things in their actions, as we have proved. Therefore he is in all things. Again, whatever is in a place, or in anything whatsoever, is, after a manner, in contact therewith, for a body is located somewhere by contact of dimensive quantity, while an incorporeal thing is said to be somewhere by contact of its power, since it lacks dimensive quantity. Accordingly, an incorporeal thing stands in relation to being somewhere by its power, as a body to being somewhere by dimensive quantity. And if there were a body having infinite dimensive quantity, it would of necessity be everywhere. Consequently, if there be an incorporeal thing with infinite power, it must needs be everywhere. Now we proved in the first book that God has infinite power. Therefore he is everywhere. Besides, as an individual cause is to an individual effect, so is a universal cause to a universal effect. Now the individual cause must needs be present to its proper effect. Thus fire by its substance gives out heat, and the soul by its essence gives life to the body. Since, then, God is the universal cause of all being, as we proved in the second book, it follows that wherever being is to be found, there also is God present. Furthermore, if an agent be present to but one of its effects, its action cannot extend to other things except through that one, because agent and patient must be simultaneous. Thus the motive power moves the various members of the body not otherwise than through the heart. Consequently, if God be present to but one of his effects, such as the first movable, which is moved by him immediately, it would follow that his action cannot extend to other things except through that first effect. But this is unreasonable, for if the action of an agent cannot extend to other things except through some first effect, the latter must correspond proportionately to the agent as regards the agent's whole power, else the agent could not use its whole power. Thus we see that all the movements which the motive power is able to cause can be performed by the heart. Now there is no creature through which can be done everything that the divine power is capable of doing, for the divine power surpasses infinitely every created thing, as we proved in the first book. Consequently, it is unreasonable to say that the divine action does not extend to other things except through some first thing. Therefore he is present, not in one only, but in all his effects. For it would amount to the same if someone were to say that he is in some, and not in all, because no matter how many divine effects we take, they will not suffice to carry into effect the execution of the divine power. Moreover, the active cause must needs be joined together with its proximate and immediate effect. Now in each thing there is a proximate and immediate effect of God, for we proved in the second book that God alone can create. Also, in each thing there is something caused by creation. In bodies, there is primary matter; in incorporeal beings there is their simple essence, as is clear from what we have said in the second book. Accordingly, God must be present in all things at the same time, especially since those things he called into being from non-being are continually preserved in being by him, as we have proved. Wherefore it is said, I fill heaven and earth, and if I ascend into heaven, thou art there; if I descend into hell, thou art present. Hereby we refute the error of some who said that God is in a definite part of the world, for instance in the first heaven, and in the eastern portion, so that he is the principle of the heavenly movement. Yet this statement of theirs might be upheld if rightly understood, so that the meaning be, not that God is confined to some particular part of the world, but that in the natural order, owing to the divine motion, all corporeal movement begins in one particular part. For this reason Holy Writ specially describes God as being in heaven, according to Isaiah 66, 1, heaven is my throne, and Psalms 16, the heaven of heavens is the Lord's, etc. However, the fact that God works in the lowest body is something outside the ordinary course of nature, that cannot be wrought by the power of a heavenly body, shows clearly that God is immediately present not only to the heavenly body but also to the lowest things. But we must not think that God is everywhere as though he were distributed throughout local space, one part of him here, another there, because he is all everywhere, since God, being utterly simple, has no parts. Nor is he simple in the same way as a point, which is the term of a continuous quantity, and consequently occupies a definite place therein, so that one point cannot be elsewhere than in one indivisible place. But God is indivisible as existing altogether outside the genus of continuous quantity. Consequently, he is not necessitated by his essence to a definite place, great or small, as though he needed to be in some place, for he was from eternity before there was any place. Yet by the immensity of his power he reaches all things that are in a place, because he is the universal cause of being, as we have stated. Accordingly, he is holy wheresoever he is. And yet again, we must not think that he is in things as though he were mingled with them, for we proved in the first book that he is neither the matter nor the form of anything, but he is in all things as active cause. Chapter 69. Concerning the opinion of those who withdraw from natural things their proper actions. This was an occasion of error to some who thought that no creature has an active part in the production of natural effects, so that, to wit, fire would not heat, but God would cause heat at the presence of fire, and they maintained the like of all natural effects. They endeavor to confirm this error with arguments, by showing that no form, whether substantial or accidental, is brought into being except by the way of creation, because forms and accidents cannot be made out of matter, since matter is not a part of them. Hence, if they be made, they must be made out of nothing, and this is to be created. And since creation is the act of God alone, as we proved in the second book, it would seem to follow that God brings into being forms both substantial and accidental. The opinion of certain philosophers agreed in part with this position, for, seeing that whatever is not per se must result from that which is per se, it would seem that the forms of things which do not exist by themselves but in matter, result from forms that are by themselves without matter, as though forms existing in matter were participations of forms that are without matter. For this reason Plato supposed that the species of sensible things are certain separate forms, which are causes of being to these objects of sense, in so far as these partake of them. Avicenna maintained that all substantial forms emanate from the active intelligence, but as to accidental forms he held them to be dispositions of matter, resulting from the action of lower agents disposing the matter, and in this he avoided the absurdity of the previous opinion. A sign of this apparently was that no active power can be found in these bodies except the accidental form, active and passive qualities for instance, and these would not seem capable of causing substantial forms. Moreover, in these lower things we find certain things that are not engendered from their like, animals caused through putrefaction, for instance. Wherefore apparently the forms of these are caused by higher principles. And in like manner other forms, some of which are much more perfect, some too, find proof of this in the inadequacy of natural bodies for action, because the form of every natural body is annexed to quantity. Now quantity is an obstacle to action and movement, a sign of which they see in the fact that the more we add to the quantity of a body, the heavier it becomes, and the slower its movement. Whence they conclude that no body is active, but that all bodies are purely passive. They also attempt to prove this again from the fact that every patient is subject to the agent, and that every agent, save the first which creates, requires a subject inferior to itself. But no substance is inferior to a body. Therefore seemingly no body is active. They add that the corporeal substance is the furthest removed from the first agent, wherefore they do not see how the active power can reach as far as the corporeal substance, and maintain that, as God is purely active, so the corporeal substance, being the lowest thing of all, is purely passive. For these reasons, then, Avicenna, Tract. 2. 3. Held that no body is active, but that the power of a spiritual substance pervading through bodies produces the actions which seem to be performed by bodies. Moreover, certain Muslim theologians are said to have argued that even accidents are not the result of corporeal activity, because an accident does not pass from one subject to another. Hence they deem it impossible for heat to pass from a hot body into another body so as to heat it, but that all like accidents are created by God. However, many absurdities arise from the foregoing positions. For if no inferior cause, above all a body, is active, and if God works alone in all things, Since God is not changed through working in various things, no diversity will follow among the effects through the diversity of the things in which God works. Now this is evidently false to the senses, for from the application of a hot body there follows not cooling but only heating, and from human seed is generated a man only. Therefore the causing of inferior effects is not to be ascribed to the divine power so as to withdraw the casualty of inferior agents. Again, it is contrary to the notion of wisdom that anything should be done in vain in the works of a wise man. But if creatures did nothing at all towards the production of effects, and God alone wrought everything immediately, other things would be employed by him in vain for the production of effects. Therefore the above position is incompatible with divine wisdom. Besides, he who gives a principle, gives whatever results from the principle. Thus the cause that gives gravity to an element, gives it downward movement. Now to make a thing actual results from being actual, as we see to be the case in God, for he is pure act, and is also the first cause of being in all things, as we proved above. If therefore he bestowed his likeness on others in respect of being, in so far as he brought things into being, it follows that he also bestowed on them his likeness in the point of acting, so that creatures too should have their proper actions. Further, perfection of effect indicates perfection of cause, since greater power produces a more perfect effect. Now God is the most perfect agent. Therefore things created by him must needs receive perfection from him. Consequently to detract from the creature's perfection is to detract from the perfection of the divine power. But if no creature exercises an action for the production of an effect, much is detracted from the perfection of the creature, because it is due to the abundance of its perfection, that a thing is able to communicate to another the perfection that it has. Therefore this opinion detracts from the divine power. Moreover, just as it belongs to the good to produce a good, so it belongs to the sovereign good to make a thing best. Now God is the sovereign good, as we proved in the first book. Therefore it belongs to him to make all things best. Now it is better that the good bestowed on someone should be common to many, than that it should be proper to one, since the common good is always considered more godlike than the good of one only. But the good of one becomes common to many, if it flows from the one to the other, and this can only be when the one, by its own action, communicates it to the others, and if it has not the power to transmit it to others, that good remains its own property. Accordingly God communicated his goodness to his creatures in such wise that one thing can communicate to another the good it has received. Therefore it is derogatory to the divine goodness to deny things their proper operations. Again, to take order away from creatures is to deny them the best thing they have, because each one is good in itself, while altogether they are very good on account of the order of the universe, for the whole is always better than the parts, and is their end. Now if we subtract action from things, the order among things is withdrawn, because things differing in nature are not bound together in the unity of order, except through the fact that some are active and some passive. Therefore it is unreasonable to say that things have not their proper actions. Besides, if effects be produced not by the act of creatures but only by the act of God, the power of a created cause cannot possibly be indicated by its effect, since the effect is no indication of the cause's power, except by reason of the action which proceeds from the power and terminates in the effect. Now the nature of a cause is not known from its effect except in so far as this is an indication of its power which results from its nature. Consequently if creatures exercise no action in producing effects, it will follow that the nature of a creature can never be known from its effect, so that all knowledge of physical science would be denied us. For it is there that arguments from effects are chiefly employed. Further, by induction it can be proved that like produces like. That which is produced in lower things is not a mere form, but a composite of matter and form, because every generation is movement out of something, namely matter, and to something, namely form. Therefore the producer must be not a mere form, but composed of matter and form. Therefore the cause of forms which exist in matter is not the separate species of things, as the Platonists maintained, nor the active intellect, as Avicenna said, but an individual composed of matter and form. Again, if action is consequent to being actual, It is unreasonable that the more perfect act be deprived of action. Now the substantial form is a more perfect act than the accidental. Consequently, if the accidental forms incorporeal things have their proper actions, much more has the substantial form an operation proper to it. But this action does not consist in disposing matter, because this is effected by alteration, for which accidental forms suffice. Therefore the form of the generator is the principle of the action whereby the substantial form is introduced into the thing generated. The arguments they adduce are easily solved, for since a thing is made that it may be, just as a form is called a being, not as though itself had being, but because by it the composite is, so neither is the form made, properly speaking, but it begins to be through the composite being brought from potentiality to the act which is the form. Nor is it necessary that whatever has a form by way of participation, receive it from that which is a form essentially, for it may receive it immediately from something having a like form in a like manner, namely by participation, and acting by virtue of the separate form, if there be any such, and thus like agent produces like effect. Nor does it follow, because every action of inferior bodies is effected through active or passive qualities, which are accidents, that nothing, save accidents, results from those actions, because even as those accidental forms are caused by the substantial form, which together with matter is the cause of the proper accidents, so do they act by virtue of the substantial form. Now that which acts by virtue of another produces an effect like not only to itself, but also, and more, to that by virtue of which it acts. Thus the action of the instrument reproduces in the work done the likeness of the art, so that the action of accidental forms produces substantial forms, inasmuch as they act instrumentally by virtue of substantial forms. As to animals generated from putrefaction, the substantial form is caused in them through the agency of a body, the heavenly body, to wit, that is the first principle of alteration. Consequently, in this lower sphere whatever acts dispositively to a form, must act by virtue of that body, so that the virtue of the heavenly body suffices without an univocal agent, for the production of certain imperfect forms, whereas for the production of more perfect forms, such as the souls of the higher animals, an univocal agent is required besides the celestial agent, for such animals are not produced otherwise than by seed. Hence Aristotle says, that man and the sun generate man. Again, it is untrue that quantity is an obstacle to a form's activity except accidentally, namely in so far as all continuous quantity is in matter. Thus the form which exists in matter, through being less actual, has less active virtue, so that the body which has less matter and more form, fire, for instance, is more active. But if we suppose the measure of action of which a form existing in matter is capable, then quantity favors an increase rather than a decrease of action, for the greater the fiery body, supposing the heat to be equally intense, the more heat does it give, and supposing an equally intense gravity, the greater a heavy body is, the more apt will be its natural movement, and for the same reason the slower will its non-natural movement be. Accordingly the fact that heavy bodies are slower in their non-natural movements, through being of greater quantity, is no proof that quantity is an obstacle to action, but rather that it is a help to its increase. Again, it does not follow that all bodies are without action, because in the order of things, corporeal substance is of the lowest kind, since even among bodies one is higher, more formal and more active than another, as fire in comparison with lower bodies, and yet not even the lowest body is excluded from activity. For it is clear that a body cannot be wholly active, since it is composed of matter, which is potential being, and form which is act. For a thing acts according as it is actual, wherefore every body acts in respect of its form, to which the other body, the patient to wit, is compared as regards its matter, as subject, inasmuch as its matter is in potentiality to the form of the agent. If, on the other hand, the matter of the active body be in potentiality to the form of the passive body, they will be mutually active and passive, as in the case of two elementary bodies, or else, one will be purely active and the other purely passive in relation to it. As the heavenly body compare to the elementary body, accordingly a body acts on a subject not by reason of its entirety, but by reason of the form by which it works. Nor is it true that bodies are furthest removed from God, for as God is pure act, things are more or less distant from Him according as they are more or less in act or potentiality. And that of all things is furthest distant from God, which is pure potentiality, namely primary matter, which is therefore purely passive and nowise active. On the other hand, bodies, being composed of matter and form, approach to a likeness to God, inasmuch as they have a form, which Aristotle 1:6-9 calls a divine thing, wherefore they act inasmuch as they have a form, and are passive, inasmuch as they have matter. Again, it is absurd to say that a body is not active because accidents do not pass from one subject to another. For when we say that a hot body gives heat, we do not mean that the identical heat which is in the heater passes into the heated body, but that by virtue of the heat in the heater, another heat, individually distinct, becomes actual in the heated body, having been potentially therein before. Because the natural agent does not transmit its own form into another subject, but reduces the passive subject from potentiality to act. Consequently, we do not deny creatures their proper actions, although we ascribe all the effects of creatures to God, as operating in all.